Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. David Lynch, Dreams, Dread, and the Subconscious. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 34 minutes. You're listening to Filmmaking Giants. This is a show about craft, but not craft as a checklist. Craft as a way of seeing. And today's figure is one of the rare directors who didn't just develop a style. He taught audiences to accept a different kind of reality. Not the reality of facts, not the reality of realism, but the reality of feeling. The way dread arrives before the reason. The way desire pulls you into a room you know you shouldn't enter. The way a sound in the dark can change the meaning of a face. David Lynch is often described with the easiest word available, surreal, but that word is too small for what he does. Surrealism can be decorative. It can be playful. It can be a museum of oddness. Lynch's work is not primarily odd. It is intimate. It's emotional. It is rooted in the way a normal day can suddenly split open and reveal something underneath that was always there, humming, waiting. He doesn't make weird films. He makes films about the moment the familiar becomes unbearable. To understand why Lynch matters, you have to start with a paradox. His imagery is so distinctive that it's become a cultural shorthand, red curtains, a backward voice, a ceiling fan, a dark highway at night, a severed ear in the grass, yet none of it functions as a brand. It functions like a nervous system. The images are not symbols you decode once. They are stimuli. They work on you the way a smell works on you. They bypass argument. They go straight to sensation. And if you trace Lynch's career, you see that his real medium isn't plot. It's atmosphere. Not vibes in the lazy sense, but atmosphere as an engineered psychological space built from sound, light, timing, performance, and a very specific kind of patience. Lynch is one of the few major directors who treats sound design the way other directors treat dialogue, as the primary carrier of meaning. In his films, a low rumble can be a character. A distant hiss can be the beginning of a scene. Silence can be a threat. Lynch was born in 1946 in Missoula, Montana, and grew up moving around the United States. That constant relocation matters in a subtle way. If you move often as a child, you become sensitive to surfaces, how normality is performed in each new place, what people say to seem polite, what they hide to seem stable. Lynch's work is obsessed with this, the performance of normality, especially in small-town America, and the violence or fear that can sit right behind it like a second face. He originally trained as a painter, and that never left him. The way he frames objects, the way he uses texture, the way he lets an image sit long enough for you to feel its weight. This comes from someone who thinks in still images first. Many directors cover scenes. Lynch composes spaces. He builds rooms you can feel. His movies often behave like paintings that have been given time. His first major statement was Eraserhead, a film that still feels like a dare. It is black and white industrial nightmare, claustrophobic and strangely tender, a story that seems at first like an abstraction but reveals itself as a primal fear. The fear of responsibility, the fear of parenthood, the fear that your life will become something you cannot manage. Eraserhead is not a film that explains itself. It is a film that commits. It commits to a dream logic and then asks you to meet it there. That commitment becomes a recurring Lynch principle. He doesn't apologize to the audience. He doesn't translate. He doesn't step outside the world to reassure you that everything will make sense later. He trusts the unconscious. He trusts that you will feel your way through. But what made Lynch truly transformative was what he did next, how he took that dream logic and fused it with recognizably American forms. In Blue Velvet, he created what might be the clearest statement of his central theme, the surface of a pleasant American town and the rot beneath it, not as a sociological claim, but as an emotional truth. The film begins with an almost parody of suburban happiness, green lawns, bright skies, a white fence, a smiling fireman waving. And then the camera goes down, into the grass, where insects writhe in the dirt. Lynch is telling you immediately, the world you're looking at is layers, and the layer you prefer is not the layer that runs the system. Blue Velvet is also where Lynch's use of sound becomes unmistakable. There's always a hum, a pressure, a feeling that the air is charged. The movie's violence feels ritualistic, staged like a nightmare you can't wake up from. And the performances matter. Lynch directs actors toward a heightened sincerity, not realism, but emotional clarity. His characters often speak as if they're trying to hold themselves together by repeating the correct line. That's why his dialogue can sound off. It's not bad writing. It's people clinging to the script of normal life while their minds slide. That's also why Lynch is so often imitated and so rarely matched. Many directors copy his surface, the odd line, the sudden violence, the ironic music. But Lynch's power comes from a deeper coherence. His films aren't random. They're governed by a consistent emotional physics. Desire pulls you toward danger. Curiosity becomes complicity, and the moment you look too closely, the world looks back. This is also where the Lynchian label gets misleading. People use it to mean quirky weirdness. But Lynch is not quirky. His films are often terrifying. They contain humor, yes, but it's the nervous humor of someone laughing because they can't do anything else. The dread is not an accessory. It's the engine. When Lynch moved into television with Twin Peaks, he did something that shouldn't have worked. He took the structure of a small-town murder mystery and let it open into metaphysics, comedy, soap opera, horror, romance, and absurdity, all while keeping audiences emotionally attached to the people in the town. The brilliance of Twin Peaks is that it doesn't start as weird. It starts as familiar, and then it expands slowly, like a dream you can't control. The murder of Laura Palmer is the story hook, but it becomes a moral stain. The show keeps asking, what did we not see? What did we choose not to see? What did we permit by calling it normal? Laura becomes less a victim in a plot and more a symbol of the hidden suffering that a community can build its denial around. And here again is Lynch's key craft lesson. He understands that mystery isn't just a narrative device. Mystery is a feeling. It's the sensation of something present but not named. You can create it with plot, but you can also create it with sound, with lighting, with pacing, with the wrong pause after a sentence. Lynch uses every tool. He also understands that the subconscious is not tidy. It doesn't deliver meaning in clean metaphors. It delivers fragments, a face, a phrase, a room, a sound that shouldn't be there. Lynch treats those fragments with respect. He doesn't force them into explanations. This becomes even more pronounced in Mulholland Drive, which is often described as a puzzle, but it's better understood as a tragedy of identity and desire. The film begins with the promise of Hollywood, reinvention, romance, possibility. It feels like a dream of becoming, but as it unfolds, it reveals the nightmare inside that dream. The way ambition can hollow you out, the way fantasy can become a trap, the way the image you create can devour the person who created it. What Lynch does in Mulholland Drive, and this is crucial for filmmakers, is that he uses structure as psychology. The film's form isn't just nonlinear. It behaves like a mind trying to protect itself. It behaves like denial, wish fulfillment, rearrangement. When the film shifts, it doesn't feel like a writer playing games. It feels like a consciousness cracking. And then there's the sound. Lynch doesn't simply score scenes. He sculpts them with sound. The low tones, the distant rumbles, the sudden silences. These aren't just mood. They're the film's subconscious speaking. If you're a filmmaker listening to this, here's the craft insight that sits underneath all of Lynch's work. He treats cinema as a sensory art first and a story delivery system second. In a Lynch film, the camera doesn't just show you what happened. It shows you how it feels to be near what happened. The edit doesn't just connect actions. It controls anxiety, anticipation, confusion, relief. That's why the simplest Lynch scenes can be more intense than elaborate action sequences. A person walking down a hallway can feel like an approaching catastrophe. A phone ringing can feel like judgment. A lamp buzzing can feel like a threat. Because Lynch understands something most filmmakers forget once they master plot, the audience lives inside time. Suspense is not information. Suspense is duration. Dread is not what happens. Dread is what you feel while waiting to find out. And Lynch is a master of that waiting. He will hold longer than you expect. He will let a scene breathe past comfort. He will make you sit in the space where your mind starts generating possibilities, and that's where fear is born. The audience becomes complicit. You start imagining what could happen, and then when it happens, you realize the film didn't place the fear in you. You placed it in yourself. That is one of Lynch's deepest tricks. He turns the viewer into a collaborator. He gives you enough ambiguity that your subconscious starts working. The film becomes a mirror, not of your literal life, but of your internal machinery. The way you fill gaps, the way you anticipate danger, the way desire can override judgment. This is why Lynch remains the most imitated director alive and why most imitations fail. They copy the gestures but not the method. They add weirdness without building dread. They add symbolism without building sensation. They treat ambiguity as decoration rather than as an engine. One of the easiest mistakes people make when they talk about David Lynch is to treat him like a riddle maker, like his primary goal is to confuse. But confusion is not the destination in Lynch. It's a tool. He uses it the way a composer uses dissonance, to destabilize you just enough that something deeper can slip in. The deeper thing is almost always emotional. And once you see that, you start to understand why his films feel so coherent even when they refuse to explain themselves. They're coherent because they're consistent about what they're doing to your nervous system. Lynch's great subject is not weirdness. His great subject is the gap between how people present themselves and what they actually live with inside. That gap is the space where shame grows, where violence hides, where desire turns into compulsion, where a town can smile while burying its children. He returns to that gap obsessively because it is the most human place he knows. This is why Americana matters in his work, not as nostalgia, but as a mask. In Lynch, American imagery is often hyper-clean, almost too bright. White fences, red roses, diners, polite conversations, the promise that everything is fine. He doesn't use these images to celebrate them. He uses them as a stage set. He is fascinated by the way a culture can develop a vocabulary of reassurance. The right smile, the right greeting, the right optimism. And then he shows you what that vocabulary can cover. When Blue Velvet opens with those saturated, almost cartoon-perfect suburban images, it's not a joke. It's a spell. It's the spell of normal. The camera sinking into the grass isn't just an iconic moment. It's a declaration of method. Lynch will always go under the surface. He will always show you the insects. But he doesn't do it with cynicism. That's another misunderstanding. Lynch is not a sneering satirist. He can be brutally honest about cruelty, but he also holds a strange tenderness for innocence, especially the fragile kind that tries to survive in a harsh world. His films often contain characters who seem naive, even foolishly sincere, and he treats them with respect. That sincerity is not mocked. It's placed under pressure. In Lynch, innocence is not stupidity. It's a kind of courage. This is part of what makes his actors look different from actors in many contemporary films. Lynch does not direct toward everyday naturalism. He directs toward a heightened clarity, sometimes almost theatrical, sometimes deliberately stiff, sometimes exaggerated, sometimes whisper quiet. But it's never random. It's always in service of a mood. He uses performance the way he uses lighting, as part of the atmosphere. Consider the way people speak in Twin Peaks. There's an odd politeness, a slightly too precise tone, a rhythm that feels like everyone is performing being normal. This creates comedy, but it also creates unease because it implies that normality is not natural. It's an act. And if it's an act, it can fail. The moment it fails, when the wrong phrase slips out, when a face flashes a different expression for half a second, that's where the dread comes from. Lynch's craft is built on those micro failures. He understands that horror does not require monsters. Horror can be the moment you realize someone's smile is not connected to their eyes. Horror can be a perfectly ordinary room that suddenly feels like it shouldn't exist. Horror can be the fact that a sound does not match the space you're in. Lynch can terrify you with a lamp. That brings us to sound design, which may be his most important contribution to filmmaking craft. Many directors treat sound as support. It carries dialogue, it adds realism, it fills silence, it delivers music cues. Lynch treats sound as a primary narrative force. In his films, sound is not a layer added after the fact. It is architecture. It defines the space you're in, and it defines the emotional truth of that space. There are Lynch scenes you can almost hear, even if you haven't seen them in years, because the sound is the scene. The low industrial hum in Eraserhead, the ominous whoosh behind a quiet conversation, the sudden distortion of an ordinary noise until it becomes threatening, the way a distant rumble can feel like an oncoming storm inside a room. Why does this matter so much? Because sound is intimate. It bypasses analysis. It enters your body. You can close your eyes and still be affected by it. You can disagree with an image intellectually, but sound tends to go beneath debate. Lynch uses that. He creates psychological pressure with frequencies, texture, and timing. Sometimes it's barely audible, but your body notices. If you're a filmmaker, here's a practical craft lesson. Lynch uses sound to make the invisible present. He makes something is wrong feel like a physical condition. And once the audience feels that condition, the story can move in dream logic because the foundation is already in your nervous system. This is also why Lynch's pacing is so distinctive. He often holds longer than other directors would. He refuses to cut away just because the plot point has been delivered. He stays with the aftermath of a line, the space around a reaction, the silence after a question. This is not indulgence. It is tension building. It is also realism of a different kind, not realism of behavior, but realism of sensation. In real life, fear doesn't end cleanly when the event ends. It lingers. Lynch films the linger. Nowhere is this more evident than in Mulholland Drive, which many people try to treat as a puzzle with a solution. But if you watch it as a puzzle, you miss the point. Mulholland Drive is a film about identity and desire collapsing under the weight of fantasy. It uses dream structure because the story itself is about a mind that cannot face what it has become. One of Lynch's greatest strengths is that he can make a narrative shift feel like an emotional truth rather than a plot twist. When Mulholland Drive turns, it doesn't feel like a screenwriter showing off. It feels like a psyche protecting itself, then failing to do so. The film structure behaves like denial, creating an alternate version where things went right, where love is pure, where success is possible, where betrayal didn't happen. And then reality returns, not as a clear explanation, but as a pressure that breaks the dream. This is cinema doing what cinema does best, showing the relationship between fantasy and reality without reducing it to speech. Lynch doesn't tell you, this is denial.
He makes you live inside it.
And the performances in Mulholland Drive are key. Naomi Watts, in particular, moves through multiple emotional registers, wide-eyed hope, panic, seduction, despair, with a clarity that feels like watching someone split in two. Lynch gives actors room to be sincere in extreme emotional territory. He's not interested in irony as a default. He's interested in what happens when emotion becomes too big for the life that contains it. That sincerity is what makes him dangerous to imitate. Many filmmakers try to mimic Lynch by adding ironic distance, winking at the weirdness, making sure the audience knows the director knows it's odd. Lynch rarely winks. He commits. He treats the dream as real while you're inside it. That's why it works. The moment you start winking, the spell breaks. If you want to see Lynch's mastery of this spell, you can look at a single scene that has become almost mythic, the Club Silencio sequence in Mulholland Drive. It is built like a ritual. A performer tells you that there is no band, no orchestra, no live sound. Yet the sound continues. You are explicitly told that what you are hearing is an illusion, and still you are moved. The scene is not about trickery. It's about the fact that art can produce real emotion even when you know it's constructed. It's about the way humans can be devastated by something they know is not real. That's cinema in a sentence. Lynch's work is full of these moments, moments where he turns the mechanics of film and television into part of the meaning. He is not simply telling stories. He is making you aware that you are dreaming while dreaming, and then forcing you to admit that the dream still hurts. Now consider Twin Peaks again, because Lynch's influence on television is often underestimated. Twin Peaks did not invent serialized storytelling, but it changed what mainstream television could tolerate. It brought atmosphere and ambiguity into a space that had been dominated by clean resolutions and familiar rhythms. It made space for slowness, for silence, for scenes that function more like poetry than plot. It also proved that audiences could be loyal to mood itself, to the feeling of a world, rather than to a sequence of solved problems. That legacy is everywhere now. Many modern prestige shows borrow Lynch's patience, his tonal mixing, his willingness to let mystery breathe. But again, the imitations often miss the heart. They borrow the style without the sincerity. They borrow the strangeness without the tenderness. Because in Lynch, tenderness is always there, even when the darkness is overwhelming. In Twin Peaks, there is genuine love for the town's odd people, their rituals, their quirks, their small moments of kindness. The coffee is not just a joke. It's a comfort. The pie is not just set dressing. It's a small ritual of stability. Lynch knows that a world is not made only of its horrors. It is made of what people cling to. Which brings us to something else Lynch does that filmmakers should study closely. He builds worlds through texture rather than exposition. You don't learn a Lynch world by being told about it. You learn it by hearing its sounds, seeing its rooms, watching how people move inside it. He uses repeated objects, repeated gestures, repeated phrases the way a musician uses motifs. That repetition creates hypnosis. It also creates meaning through accumulation. A ceiling fan becomes ominous not because someone says it's ominous, but because Lynch has taught you to feel it that way. When people say David Lynch makes films like dreams, they often mean it as a polite way of saying the films don't make sense. But dreams do make sense, just not in the way a police report makes sense. Dreams have logic, but it's emotional logic. They bind together images and events because of how they feel, not because of chronology. They jump because your mind jumps. They repeat because your fear repeats. They distort because your desire distorts. Lynch didn't stumble into that. He engineered it, and he did it with craft choices that filmmakers can actually study and apply. The first thing to understand is that Lynch treats cinema as a machine for producing states of mind. Many directors build scenes like arguments. Here's the information. Here's the character motivation. Here's the conflict. Here's the resolution. Lynch builds scenes like weather systems. You enter a mood, the pressure changes, something in the air becomes charged, and you begin to anticipate lightning even before you see clouds. That anticipation is not a side effect. It is the point. This is why Lynch's films often feel slow to people trained on plot. They're slow because they're not rushing you toward a fact. They're letting the feeling accumulate. The feeling is what makes the later event land as something more than a story beat. And because he's building states of mind, Lynch is obsessed with thresholds, literal and psychological. Doors, hallways, curtains, staircases, roads at night, elevators, hidden rooms, back alleys, basements. These are not just locations. They are transitions. They are the places where the world changes rules. In a Lynch film, stepping into a hallway is often more dangerous than stepping into a battlefield because it suggests you're moving from one reality to another without being prepared. That's why he loves curtains. Curtains are the perfect symbol and the perfect tool. They hide and reveal. They suggest a stage. They imply performance, and they turn space into mystery. In Twin Peaks, the red curtains aren't just an iconic look. They are a boundary between worlds. When you see them, you know you are somewhere you do not fully understand. The second thing to understand is that Lynch weaponizes the ordinary. He doesn't need gothic castles. He doesn't need elaborate creatures. He can take a clean suburban street and make it terrifying by changing one variable: sound, timing, framing, or performance. That's a profound lesson because it means you can create dread without expensive production. You can create dread by turning the audience's perception against them. For Lynch, dread often begins with a mismatch. A cheerful song over a disturbing image. A friendly conversation in a space that feels wrong. A face smiling while the room hums like a power station. A banal line delivered with a pause that suggests something unspoken. These mismatches create cognitive friction. The audience feels the friction and tries to resolve it. When it can't be resolved, the audience enters uncertainty, and uncertainty is the natural habitat of fear. This is why Lynch's tonal shifts are so powerful. He can pivot from comedy to horror without changing the frame. Someone says something funny, you laugh, and then you realize you shouldn't have. That is not just tonal play. It's moral and psychological. It reminds you how close laughter can be to panic, how humor can be a defense against dread, how quickly a room can change. The third thing, the thing that turns Lynch from stylish to master, is his use of sound as a moral force. In Lynch, sound is not just atmosphere. It is judgment. It is the presence of something unseen. A low rumble isn't just spooky. It implies machinery, power, inevitability. A hiss implies leakage. A buzz implies nerves. A distant roar implies that the world outside the frame is alive and not indifferent. He also uses silence with extraordinary control. Silence in Lynch is not absence. It's focus. It's the moment when the film stops guiding you and lets your own mind fill the space. The mind does not fill silence with calm. It fills it with expectation, with dread, with memory. That's why silence can be louder than music. And then there's the way Lynch uses music itself, not simply as score, but as a kind of spell. He often places characters in relation to music in a way that feels ritualistic, singing on stage, slow dances, performances that seem too sincere to be safe. Music becomes a portal. It becomes a moment when emotion is allowed to surface without permission, and that surfacing can be beautiful or catastrophic. This is what makes Lynch's cinema subconscious cinema. It bypasses analysis and touches the raw parts: fear, desire, shame, longing, nostalgia, grief. It makes you feel something before it tells you why. Now, why is Lynch so imitated? Because he provides a vocabulary that modern visual culture loves. Red curtains, neon lights, slow motion faces, menacing calm, strange humor, dreamlike repetition. You can borrow these elements and instantly signal art film, prestige, mystery, or cool weirdness. But here's the danger. Lynch's vocabulary is not what makes him Lynch. His method makes him Lynch. The method is, commit to a feeling, design every element to support that feeling, and refuse to explain away what the feeling is doing. The method is, let ambiguity work as pressure, not as a riddle. The method is, treat the audience's subconscious as part of your storytelling toolset. If you're a filmmaker, what should you steal from Lynch? Steal his patience. Steal his willingness to hold a shot past comfort. Steal his understanding that suspense lives in time. Steal his idea that sound can carry narrative weight equal to dialogue. Steal his use of repetition to create hypnosis. Steal his respect for sincerity, his refusal to protect himself with irony. But do not steal his decorations unless you know why they work. Because the worst Lynchian, work is just a costume. Quirky lines, random violence, odd music cues. It confuses without moving. It imitates the surface and forgets the engine. Lynch's engine is emotional truth. Even when his stories break reality, the feelings never do. The dread is real. The longing is real. The shame is real. The desire is real. That's why Mulholland Drive hurts. It hurts because it is not an intellectual exercise. It is a portrait of someone collapsing under the weight of a dream that turned into a trap. That collapse is human. It's also why Twin Peaks remains so haunting. It's not just the mystery of Laura Palmer. It's the sense that a community can build its identity on not seeing what is right in front of it. The horror is not supernatural first. The horror is denial. And perhaps that's Lynch's most enduring gift. He made the subconscious respectable as a place to make cinema. He made it possible for mainstream audiences to accept that not everything meaningful can be said in plain sentences. He legitimized mood as meaning. He legitimized fear that has no object. He legitimized the idea that a film can be a psychological experience rather than a plot delivery system. This changed not only auteurs, but entire industries. You can see Lynch's fingerprints in modern horror that relies on atmosphere rather than jump scares. You can see him in prestige television that treats mood as narrative. You can see him in advertising that uses dream imagery. You can see him in music videos that trade logic for sensation. He is one of those creators whose influence is so widespread that people absorb it without knowing its source. And yet, despite all this, Lynch never became a mere brand. That might be his strangest achievement. In a culture that packages everything, Lynch remained stubbornly himself, an artist with a private logic, uninterested in smoothing his edges. He made the work he wanted to make, and the world adjusted around it. If you want one final Lynch image, one final craft lesson, imagine a scene where almost nothing happens. A person stands in a room. A light buzzes. A low hum grows beneath the silence. The person looks toward a hallway. The camera holds. The audience begins to dread whatever might be down that hallway, not because they were told to, but because their nervous system has been trained by the sound and the waiting. Then maybe nothing happens at all. Or maybe something happens that is almost banal. And yet the scene remains unforgettable because the film made you feel the presence of something unseen. That is David Lynch's cinema, the unseen made present. You've been listening to Filmmaking Giants. Today we explored David Lynch, dreams, dread, and the subconscious, and the craft beneath the mystique, patience, sound as psychological architecture, performance as atmosphere, Americana as mask, ambiguity as pressure, sincerity without apology. In the next episode, we'll meet Andrei Konchalovsky, the other titan of Russian cinema, often overshadowed by Tarkovsky, yet with a career that fused East and West in a way few directors ever managed, moving from Soviet epics to American genre films and back again, without losing his seriousness about human beings. Until then, thank you for listening. And remember, cinema doesn't only show you what happens. In the right hands, it shows you how it feels before you understand why.